This is Network Europe.
Stockholm, Paris, Berlin, Kiev, Ljubljana, Bratislava, Amsterdam, Bucharest,
Coming up, this week's EU summit, we discuss the revival of national interest. As decision-making in the European Union becomes ever more complex, some quarters of the public want their country to pull out. But what might happen if one ever did? A brewing arms scandal overshadows the Paris Air Show, and Austria bids a complicated and nuanced farewell to a former president. These stories and more in this edition of Network Europe, a partnership of Europe's leading international broadcasters. At the helm in Stockholm today, I'm Mark Cummins. Great to have you with us. Also, a little later in the program.
Just across Warsaw's Poniatowski Bridge, where few tourists dare to tread, is a place where Nigerians and Vietnamese speak Polish, clothes of all kinds are comically cheap, and an underground economy of CDs, DVDs, and cigarettes thrives pretty much out in the open.
A piece of history about to disappear from life in Warsaw. But first, European leaders this week converged on Brussels for talks on the controversial EU treaty at a two-day summit in Brussels, which began on Thursday. But while Germany, who holds the rotating presidency, has worked all year on a new compromise treaty instead of the much-aligned EU-wide constitution, governments around the EU went to the summit assuring their voters that they would stand firm on their own position. Some of them, notably the UK and Poland, have long threatened to veto the new treaty if it didn't serve their national interest. It all seems a far cry from the days when the majority of European leaders talked happily about forging an ever closer union. Or does it? Network Europe's Brussels correspondent Stephen Castle joins me on the line. Stephen, is quoting national interest enjoying a revival in the EU?
Yes, I think really what we're seeing is a consequence of enlargement of the EU, not just the last two enlargements, the one this year with Romania and Bulgaria and the previous 10 countries that came in 2004, but a succession of enlargements. I think when you had six founder members of the EU, it was relatively easy to get some form of common interest. I mean, it wasn't always possible, but it was comparatively easy. With 27 countries, the common interest there is always going to be much more remote. So I think that's really one of the key factors. I mean, I think there are a couple of other factors. One, that there's a generation of leaders that has changed, really, in Europe. If you look, for example, at the way that politics is conducted on the European stage by, for example, a succession of British prime ministers, or now the Polish prime minister and president, the Kaczynski twins. I mean, we're really not talking about the era of Kohl and Mitterrand, those leaders who emerged from the Second World War with a mission to reunite Europe and to increase harmony between France and Germany. So I think that there has been quite a significant change, yes.
Does national interest and defining the national interest in this perspective, does it mean just getting more money out of the European Union common coffers, so to speak?
Well, I think for some countries, that will be the main driving force, and particularly countries that are going to be net beneficiaries from the EU, the newer and poorer member states. But of course, let's not forget there are a whole raft of countries now that are net payers, countries that never thought of themselves as rich countries, countries like, for example, Ireland, which will become a net payer into the EU rather than taking money out of the EU. And I think the other thing that one has to remember, and this applies both to the richer countries and to the poorer countries, is the impact of domestic politics. For example, the United Kingdom, its arguments with the mini treaty that leaders have been trying to negotiate, it's nothing to do with money at all. It's to do with satisfying domestic public opinion that this treaty is something very different from the constitution, which was rejected by the French and Dutch voters in 2005.
Just the fact that we see so many differing national interests at play, does it in effect mean that the EU has failed perhaps to meld all these national interests together, that still many years, at least for many members, many years after they've joined the EU, there is still this national interest that's perhaps not for the common good of the rest of the Union?
Well, I think that is certainly true. I think one oughtn't to underestimate the difficulties that there have always been in reconciling European positions. I mean, when it was just six countries, it was a lot easier, relatively simple. But even then, there were big differences. And actually, one of the great advantages of the alliance between France and Germany was that actually these countries are extremely different nations. And if they could broker a compromise, then it was likely to work for most of the other member states.
Stephen Castle in Brussels, talking to us on the rise of national interest. You're listening to Network Europe. Now, as the decision-making process within the European Union becomes ever more complicated, some people wonder about what would happen if the Union ever became so deadlocked that countries chose to leave it. This program has been reporting on virtual reality worlds recently, so it was in that vein that Radio Netherlands decided to play with the alternative scenario of a future Dutch retreat from the EU. How much of a difference would it make if the Netherlands really ever left the Union? Radio Netherlands' Vanessa Mock takes this, I stress, fictional look at that alternative.
From Hilversum in Holland, this is Radio Netherlands, the Dutch International Service.
The government in The Hague has announced that the Netherlands will pull out of the European Union on January the 1st, 2008. The move comes after a heated summit of EU leaders who failed to agree on a new treaty for the Union. The Netherlands stood alone in discussions and has decided to go its own way. Vanessa Mock reports.
It's a historical moment for the Netherlands. Dutch Prime Minister Jan-Peter Balkenende has formally informed European leaders in Brussels that his country would leave the European Union. There was no way to agree on the future direction of the EU, he said. So it's the end of the European journey for one of the countries that founded the European Union 50 years ago. Prime Minister Balkenende says there's no going back on the decision.
At this moment, I have to look to the opinion of the Dutch Parliament, and I have to look to the opinion of the Dutch population. And that's the reality at the moment. We've had a debate in the Dutch Parliament, and the message is very clear, it is a no.
While the move to leave the EU has been greeted with euphoria on the streets of the Netherlands, it seems that everyone's delighted and proud to once again be 100% Dutch and only Dutch.
Finally, it was a horror. Let's do it ourselves.
It's great. I think it's really great. Yeah.
It's a very good idea. I think it's better. It's better that Holland, some own decision, try to do.
But the Dutch decision to leave the European Union has already had a visible impact. And one of the places where you can actually see the consequences of this already is at the Dutch-German border.
Passport, please. Fahren Sie bitte sofort dort rüber. Hier ist die Schengen-Zone. Die Holländer müssen dort drüben sich einordnen, bitte.
There are huge queues here stretching out as far as the eye can see on either side of the border. Sir, how long have you been sitting in your car now?
How long? 6 hours, I think. They don't let us in Germany, I think. I'm always driving this the same way. It's ridiculous.
Chaos and confusion at the border control. Meanwhile, here in the heart of the EU in Brussels at the European Commission, I'm standing next to Friso Roskam-Abing. Mm-hmm. You're a spokesman for the Commissioner for Justice and Home Affairs. We've just seen what's happening at the border, but what does it mean for the Netherlands to be stepping out of the EU?
Why are there queues? Because Germany now, after Netherlands have reintroduced border control, suddenly, after 20 years, they have to again queue up to show their passport. I also very much hope that people will realize that as of now, the Netherlands has stepped out of a common immigration and asylum policy.
What does that mean?
It's very likely to be now the main target country for immigrants because they will know that Netherlands no longer is part of a common asylum policy system, of common immigration rules, and there is a pretty big risk now for Netherlands that they will become the magnet country. Illegal immigrants will find their way to Holland.
The guilder has made a comeback as the new national currency, and that's causing great confusion at the checkout till.
22 gulden 95, alstublieft.
Can I pay with euros?
Oh, you see, I hear this the whole day. Euros, guilders, it doesn't matter. Everything is a mess.
Hoi, hoi. Afgelopen. I can throw it all away. Look, years and years of work. Here, all these files.
A sad day for you, Jan-Marinus Wiersma, Socialist MEP here at the European Parliament, until today. What does this mean for the Netherlands?
I think it will be a kind of total isolation in Europe, and we will be ridiculed by the rest of the world. We were sitting on the table defining with the others the policies of this powerful European Union. Now we are getting to a position of a small, neutral country.
You've built up quite a lot here, a lot of dossiers here lying about. What does it mean?
Yeah, I've worked 15 years, or almost 15 years, representing also the interests of the Dutch. And Holland has done very well out of the EU. And now suddenly, because of this strange impulse of the Dutch citizens, I have to quit my job. So I think a Bulgarian MP will take this room. But I think I will be back. But of course, the damage has been done. Then we will come here, have to be very humble. And so we will have no position at all. It will take another 15 years to rebuild this.
Be careful what you wish for. Vanessa Marco of Radio Netherlands with that fictional look at what leaving the EU might actually mean for a member country. Now, back to reality. Coming up.
St. Stephen's Cathedral, Vienna, where Austrians traditionally pay last respects to former leaders. During his career, Kurt Waldheim strode the international stage and held Austria's highest position. But following his death, it was decided to give him a stately rather than state funeral.
A nuanced farewell to a complex politician in Austria. But first, an airfield in the French capital this week has been in focus as the world's aerospace industry gathers for the biannual Paris Air Show. Headlines were dominated by the heady competition for sales between Europe's airline manufacturer Airbus and its American rival Boeing. But behind the high-tech displays and glittering mock-ups, allegations that a British arms manufacturer has made payments amounting to billions of US dollars in connection with lucrative arm deals cast a shadow on the event. Radio France International's Hannah Godfrey has the details.
Under the ear-splitting roar of fighter jets performing acrobatics in the sky, deals are cinched involving tens of billions of euros. And the biannual Bourget Air Show is not just about airplanes as toys. It's a key event in the calendar of the movers and shakers of the international arms trade. One of the major affairs that's being talked about this year is known as the Al-Yamamah deal. Allegations were made earlier this month that Britain's biggest arms dealer, BAE Systems, made secret payments amounting to almost 1.5 billion euros to Saudi Prince Bandar bin Sultan, as well as buying the prince a top-of-the-range Airbus airliner, paying for its upkeep, and picking up the bill for his daughter's luxury honeymoon. All this in order to lubricate a 1985 deal under which more than 100 warheads were sold to Saudi Arabia. Riyadh is now looking to update its fleet, and a deal involving the purchase of 72 Eurofighter Typhoons from BAE looks imminent. The French and the Brits may be friends, and we may be all part of the same European family, but would it not seem likely that the French arms giant Dassault is pricking up its ears as its neighbour squirms? It's been having problems shifting its Rafale jets, and inheriting the Saudi contract would be a major boost to the French industry. This is very delicate diplomatic territory, and no trade insiders at the Bourget Fair would agree to say anything on air on the issue. But it's clear that the affair is being followed very closely. I asked analyst Richard Aboulafia from the US-based consulting firm Thiel Group whether he thinks there's any chance that the French might win the Saudi contract from the UK.
There's no question that Dassault has been interested in the Saudi market for some time, as a matter of fact, several decades. But just because one guy loses doesn't mean the other guy wins. It could be that the Saudis stay away from the arms bazaar for some time. It could also mean it's entirely conceivable they go U.S., even though politically things have been awkward recently. Up until 2000, 2001, you still had U.S. aircraft manufacturers hoping for a crack at this market. So it's very difficult to say, but there's no question that Rafale would be one of the front runners if they decided to cancel the deal and if they stayed in the market.
The whiff of scandal has been attached to the Al-Yamamah deal for a number of years now. A 30-month inquiry into the deal by the UK's Serious Fraud Office was called off by Attorney General Lord Goldsmith last December on the grounds that to continue might have harmed Britain's national and international interests. The move came a few weeks after reports that the Saudis were threatening to cancel the mooted Eurofighter purchase and deal with France instead. The British Guardian newspaper has made allegations that Britain's top legal officer concealed under-the-table payments that were being made to the Saudi prince from an OECD anti-bribery probe. Lord Goldsmith has denied these accusations. There was palpable resentment about all this on the French side at the Bourget Fair. One industry insider said that the British have not respected the rules of fair competition in acquiring and retaining the Saudi contract. Another criticised the government's halting of a judicial inquiry. The affair has certainly tarnished Britain's image on the international stage, but has it also harmed the already shaky reputation of the arms industry as a whole? I put this question to Richard Aboulafia.
I think right now the question isn't about the arms trade. I think the question is about national governance in the UK. I mean, at the end of the day, the Serious Fraud Office and journalists and whatever else have their own particular approach here, and the UK government at the very top seemed a bit divergent from that approach. And so the real question is, who can stop who from studying what? Mm. There's also the broader geopolitical implications, of course. The close relationship between Saudi Arabia and particularly the Saudi monarchy and the UK government that's been going on for, of course, many decades. So there's quite a lot at risk here.
Arms deals on this scale, particularly those involving strategically crucial countries such as Saudi Arabia, are about a lot more than promoting national industries. If the French were to succeed in supplying the kingdom with its new generation of fighter jets, this would affect not only Franco-British relations, but also alliances with one of the Anglo-Americans' key partners in the Middle East.
Radio France International's Hannah Godfrey. You're listening to Network Europe. The former United Nations Secretary General Kurt Waldheim died last week and will be buried this weekend in his native Austria, where he served a term as president. Waldheim caused an international row after he left the UN when it was revealed his service with Hitler's army during World War II included time with a unit which committed atrocities in the Balkans. As Deutsche Welle's Kerry Skyring reports from Vienna, what became known as the Waldheim affair left an unintended legacy.
St. Stephen's Cathedral, Vienna, where Austrians traditionally pay last respects to former leaders. During his career, Kurt Waldheim strode the international stage and held Austria's highest position. But following his death, it was decided to give him a stately rather than state funeral. It's a fine distinction, but an important one. The lesser honour reflects Austria's ambivalence about Waldheim and what he stood for. According to senior political commentator Annalisa Rohrer, his is an unintended legacy.
His case, or his campaign and his presidency, really forced Austria for the first time to look at herself. And some things we saw were not really a pretty sight, meaning that willingly, or more unwillingly, we had to confront some facts of the past.
The scandal surrounding Kurt Waldheim broke in 1986, after he'd left the United Nations and during his campaign for the Austrian presidency. Journalists uncovered evidence he'd lied about where and when he had served in Hitler's army during World War II. There were also allegations he'd taken part in war crimes, but these proved unfounded. In this archival recording, he defends himself from the suggestion he would have known of atrocities committed by his unit.
I had nothing whatsoever to do. That was a matter for the Abwehr officer, for the intelligence officer and his staff, for the secret military police and things like that, and mainly for the civilian German authorities, but not for the Wehrmacht.
An official inquiry cleared him of any wrongdoing, but the revelations he had deliberately repressed his whereabouts and other details of his past would haunt Waldheim to his death. They would also fundamentally change Austria.
Waldheim's repression of certain aspects of his biography, that was so Austrian. He was a typically Austrian in that. And if you remember from that time on, we really didn't manage to what we did do before, just to push our past aside, to push our role in the Nazi regime aside. So I think he, without intending to do that, he kicked something off in the country, which really, I think, has some lasting value.
The affair divided Austria into two camps, those pro-Waldheim, who believed he was the subject of an international witch hunt, and those who believed he'd damaged his own and Austria's reputation.
And it was not just Waldheim's war record that was being debated. It was the war record of many thousands of Austrians. And it was a debate about the post-war repression of that record. Was Austria Hitler's first victim, or was Austria Hitler's willing helper? These were the questions being asked in the cafes and in the living rooms. The pro-Waldheim camp seemed to win the first round of the debate when they elected Waldheim president. Franz Vernetzky was Austrian Chancellor at the time.
Dr. Waldheim hat sich ungerecht behandelt gefühlt, missverstanden.
Dr. Waldheim felt he was being treated unfairly, that he was misunderstood. And this reflex caught on in the Austrian population at large. Indeed, to the point where some Austrians felt they too were being treated unfairly, especially by foreign influences. Things like that are always unpopular here in Austria, and the voters take their revenge.
Waldheim took office, but it was a Pyrrhic victory. The United States placed him on its watch list and refused him entry. He spent one term as president and the rest of his life defending his reputation. And Annalisa Rohrer believes the whole affair could have been avoided if only Waldheim had admitted his mistake and apologized.
He couldn't bring himself to say, "I'm sorry, I tried to cover up." He just couldn't bring himself to say that.
Kurt Waldheim wanted his legacy to be that of a statesman and peacemaker. He has that in limited measure through his work for the United Nations. But many Austrians will tell you his biggest legacy is the unintended one, the ongoing debate about the actions of Austrians during the Holocaust and their coming to terms with the past.
Deutsche Welle's Kerry Skyring. You're listening to Network Europe. The Union of Communist Youth in Romania was one of the richest youth organizations in southeastern Europe. 17 years have passed since the fall of communism, and Romania has not solved the problem of what to do with the properties and assets which belong to the communist youth organization. In the battle for this heritage, civil society may be the number one loser. Radio Romania International's Julian Murasan reports from Bucharest.
I am in Victoria Road 120 in downtown Bucharest, in front of a beautiful mid-19th century building, which actually was where Ceausescu's son, Nicu, would have his parties before 1989. This building belonged to the Ministry of Culture during the communist regime, and it was just given away to Ceausescu's son. At present, this building is the headquarters of the Group for Social Dialogue, which is one of the pillars of civil society in Romania. The building also shelters the 22 weekly magazine, which is a pioneer publication of civil society, a jazz club, a famous bookstore, and an underground theater promoting young actors and directors. About 100 people have gathered in the garden of the Group for Social Dialogue, calling on the Chamber of Deputies to pass an emergency ordinance allowing the Group for Social Dialogue to keep this building, which would otherwise be given to an NGO, which is the heir to the Union of Communist Youth. Young playwright Stefan Peka is rather pessimistic about the vote in the Chamber of Deputies due at the end of this month.
We need to defend this place. That is, for me, kind of a living metaphor for artistic freedom. If they vote in the deputy chamber, that's it. It becomes law.
Vladimir Tismonanu is a professor of political science at Maryland University in the U.S. He is the man who wrote the scientific report based on which President Traian Băsescu condemned communism in front of the Romanian parliament. Anti-communism was a winning card for President Băsescu in the impeachment referendum, but according to Vladimir Tismonanu, it may be the losing card for the Group for Social Dialogue.
Civil society has gathered very strongly around the president in this battle, and it's not a matter of the man, but it's a matter of the values he stands for. The Group for Social Dialogue, via different voices, has been quite adamant in supporting these values, so I think that unfortunately it may be a form of quote-unquote retribution for these positions.
Radio Romania International's Julian Murasan with that report. Now, to end today's program, we're off to Warsaw, where one of the most fascinating places is across the Vistula River in the part of the city most tour guides ignore or even dismiss as too dangerous. The Stadion Jasienko Lecha, or the 10th anniversary stadium, is a leftover piece of architecture from Poland's recent past. Its outdoor market, one of the largest of its kind, is a special universe of sellers from all over the world. But its days are numbered. Poland's surprise win on the bid to host the 2012 European Football Championships means a brand new sports complex will be built on the site. And after June the 30th, 2007, the market will close forever. Polish Radio's Amy Droszdowska presents this obituary for a place that bears some of the last living traces of Poland's communist past, along with a brazen mix of innocent exchange and underground economy.
Just across Warsaw's Poniatowski Bridge, where few tourists dare to tread, is a place where Nigerians and Vietnamese speak Polish, clothes of all kinds are comically cheap, and an underground economy of CDs, DVDs, and cigarettes thrives pretty much out in the open. Designed by three Polish architects and completed in 1955, the Stadion Jasienko Lecha, meaning 10th anniversary stadium, was built to celebrate the first decade of communist rule and the end of World War II. In fact, it's largely built from rubble left by the war. In its heyday, it was Poland's national stadium and host to a variety of Communist Party festivals and international sports events. It accommodated as many as 100,000 spectators. But in the early 80s, technical problems and safety concerns led to the stadium's abandonment and subsequent disrepair. In the late afternoon and evening hours, when the market stalls are empty and the concentric rings of walkways are quiet, the whole place stands melancholy. Its core is an enormous, eerie assemblage of crumbling steps falling down its center, the jagged remains of ripped-up benches, and competing patches of grass and garbage. But from pre-dawn until 1 p.m. or so, it's another experience entirely. After 1989 and the collapse of communism, the stadium transformed into an arena of capitalism, a giant outdoor market home to thousands of sellers. All those manning the stalls may speak Polish, but a great deal of them are from far outside Poland's borders. In fact, because most of the sellers came from Poland's Near East, this place was known for years as the Russian market, and the perfect place to pick up Soviet souvenirs. Everything from hammer and sickle pins to Kalashnikov rifles. I've been told that the arms market here was such that at a certain point you could even buy yourself an actual tank, if you could figure out a way to carry it home. These days, it's more a place to pick up pirated CDs and counterfeit designer clothes. And vendors from Africa and Asia outnumber the Ukrainians, Belarusians, and Russians.
Where are you from?
From Zimbabwe.
I'm from India.
I am from Afghanistan.
Egypt.
I'm from Pakistan.
I'm from Bangladesh. I'm from.
Stall after stall is crammed with goods of all kinds. Varsovians and visitors alike crowd inside for some of the best deals in town.
Compared than any supermarket, it's cheap, so cheap. It's half price. Half of half price.
And though high-end new malls with names like the Golden Terraces keep cropping up on Warsaw's cityscape, it's still markets like these that offer goods at prices actually within an average Pole's budget.
I visit here for sweaters and jeans, and shoes maybe, and like my mother, jewelry.
Seekers of coats, athletic jerseys, underwear, and cosmetics come away happy. The market does have its dark underbelly, though not so dark as it used to be. Polish police have cracked down on the stadium in the past. Between 1995 and 2001, for instance, thousands of vendors were prosecuted, and millions of CDs, videotapes, and DVDs were confiscated. After the last day of June 2007, the 10th anniversary stadium will be closed for good. A large, fancy new sports complex will return the site to its original purpose and serve Poland's role as co-host of the 2012 European Football Championships. But not everyone is cheering. The stadium's vendors, the vast majority of them struggling immigrants, will have to find somewhere else to set up shop and support their lives in Poland. Shoppers will have to go elsewhere to find deals, which for some means simply finding the things they need at prices they can afford. But in the meantime, visitors to the stadium's outdoor market can marvel at a dilapidated monument to socialist values, ponder whether or not those designer perfumes are for real, and maybe even pluck up the courage to ask one of those furtive-looking men about his DVDs.
That report from Polish Radio's Amy Drozdowska. And as always, if you'd like to listen to this or any of our programs again, you can by logging onto our website at www.networkeurope.org. You'll also find information there on how you can subscribe to our podcast. We love to get feedback on our programs from our listeners. You can send your comments, suggestions, ideas, and criticisms to our email address. It's contact@networkeurope.org. That's contact@networkeurope.org. That's all we have time for today. This program is a partnership of Radio France International, Radio Sweden, Polish Radio, Deutsche Welle, Radio Netherlands, Radio Romania International, Radio Slovakia, Radio Prague, Radio Ukraine, and Radio Slovenia. I'll leave you this week with the Swedish band I'm From Barcelona with this puzzling new track called Brittany. Network Europe will be back at the same times next week. On behalf of our pan-European team, this is Mark Cummins. Thanks for joining us.
Something to they don't know.